From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, we hear a lot about the power of undecided voters, but is it possible they don't exist?
I think it may be just like the unicorn or something, this character that we'd like to imagine exists because it makes us feel good.
Our cover story today, the undecided voter. Also, the mysterious deaths of young female tourists in Southeast Asia.
Why would two young girls out of the crowds of people on the beach be the only ones who die from a poison cocktail?
And later, celebrating Tolkien's classic as it turns 75, and a reporter in search of an elusive American artist.
She told me that there was a man in Texas who designed scarves for Hermes, and he's the only American ever to do it. And then she said, and as a matter of fact, he's a postman.
Plus, Death Cab for Cutie's Ben Gibbard on his former lives.
I think it was Hemingway that said that we are strongest in our broken places.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Enjoy. If you watched the presidential debate this past week, did you think, wait, are these people really undecided? Because they were all self-declared undecided voters, people who are weighing whether to vote Obama or Romney and haven't made up their mind. Now, there's a political scientist at UCLA who says undecideds make up about 4% of the American electorate. We'll talk with her in a moment for our cover story today. The undecideds, do they exist and can they swing this election? But first, let's go to NPR's Don Gagne. He's fresh off 12 days on the campaign trail. Don, welcome back to Washington.
Glad to be here.
Okay, it's hard to believe just 2 weeks, just a little more than 2 weeks left before Election Day. And this is really going to come down to, like, voters in Ohio or in Virginia.
It may very well be Ohio, but Virginia and Iowa and Florida and Colorado, these are the states we're all kind of really focusing in on. And guess what? The candidates are focusing in on them as well. It's where all the money's being spent. It's where we're going to see them spending all their time from here on out.
Lots of money, lots of television ads going up in those places. Even New Hampshire is becoming, once again, important. New Hampshire is important in January. Now, once again, it's important in November.
New Hampshire and Iowa are really getting a chance to be part of the general election show. And I can't say they're enjoying it because it comes with all sorts of attention and ads and mailers in your mailbox and people knocking on your door and reporters like me walking up to you in the diner and saying, hey, what do you think?
Yeah, you are a nice guy. So if anyone's listening, you should talk to Don.
That's right.
Don, I want to talk about undecided voters because the last debate, of course, was full of undecided, self-declared undecided voters. On your travels, on the campaign trail, have you met many truly undecided voters?
I have come across undecided voters. I was at that Bruce Springsteen, Bill Clinton rally in Parma, Ohio this week. There's Ohio again, right? And I talked to a guy, and you assume it's all the faithful there to see the Bruce and Bill show. And this guy said, I voted for Obama last time. I'm leading Obama, but I'm undecided. And I'm going, how can that be? Why are you here? And he says, well, I'm here to see Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
But he also said, I mean, he was clearly somebody who wasn't an ideologue. So all of those things that we think of that separate these candidates, that make them so different, the undecided voters I talk to aren't really looking at all of those things. They may have voted for President Obama. They want the economy to get better. They maybe see it improving, but they're not ready to write off Governor Romney's plans yet, and they don't have to make up their mind yet, so they're still trying to sort it out. They're people who are legitimately looking for the person who will help the economy. That's what I'm finding out.
It's NPR's Don Gagne, fresh off 2 weeks on the campaign trail, and he will be back on it. Don, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to a story we read about this week in Frank Cherubino's column in the Palm Beach Post. The story begins this past Tuesday. Frank is driving his son to school.
Right, I'm taking my 13-year-old son to school, and we like listening to this local sports show. Now, we do listen to NPR on occasion, but sometimes we like to listen to sports.
No, that's okay. No apologies necessary.
No, it's true. We do both, but my son likes the sports channel. I do, too. And there's particularly, there's a show on 790 The Ticket, the morning show.
On AM 790 and FM 104.3, The Ticket.
With this guy, Mark Hockman, who's very funny, and he frequently talks about things other than sports.
Good morning, Swerdlow.
Which is one of the reasons we like it, too.
So Frank and his son are listening to Mark Hockman's show, and not far into it, the conversation turns away from sports.
That night on television, there was a choice between watching the Yankees and the Tigers play a playoff baseball game or watching the second debate.
But you got an actual presidential debate tonight.
Yeah.
You're not going to be just glued in on that.
I told you. You got 5 minutes to suck me in, all right?
And he was carrying on with his partner there, Jonathan Zaslow.
Yeah, it's actually a tug of war.
Is that how they're deciding that
one? And I heard Hochman say, I'm going to have to tune in at least for that third debate and see because I'm one of those undecided voters.
So that'll really decide my vote because I'm undecided at this point, mm-hmm. but I'll wait for the tug of war.
Yeah.
Okay, at this point in the story, Frank Cherubino's ears perk up. He's been thinking that undecided voters are kind of a myth, that there's no way anyone could still be undecided this close to the election.
And the other thing, too, is that we live in Florida. In Florida, you can't get away from your phone ringing all night long, ads back to back to back on television. So the idea that somebody who is smart and literate has not paid attention enough to make a decision, to me, just didn't seem right. But then when I heard Hochman say,
because I'm undecided at this point, but
that he was undecided, and I thought, well, this is an intelligent guy. Maybe I have this all wrong.
So Frank Cherubino called him up.
Yeah, Frank Cherubino called me, and he said, you know, I listen to your radio program every morning.
I told him, I said, Mark, I listen to your show, and I happened to hear you this morning say you're an undecided voter.
He said, it strikes me as odd that you wouldn't have made up your mind already. And I shared a secret with Frank, and I said, I'm a Democrat. I actually have made up my mind about the election. I was just saying that on the air because it's just not worth it on sports radio to take a side. I mean, this country, we've never been more divided, I don't think. We are 50-50 each way. So I wasn't saying whether I was Democrat or Republican. I was just kind of being aloof on the air and saying, well, I'm still an undecided voter.
Once he told me that, it kind of made me feel reassured because of course he's made up his mind. He just says that just because he doesn't want to get into a political conversation on the radio. Then I thought, well, see, I think I'm right.
Did you watch that debate with those
yes.
undecided voters? And what did you think?
Well, I thought if you waterboarded each of those people, they'd tell you exactly who they were voting for. No, I don't. I think it may be just like the unicorn or something, this character that we'd like to imagine exists because it makes us feel good.
We wanted a more scientific answer to this question, so we called up Lynn Vavreck. She's a political scientist at UCLA, and she's been tracking the same group of 44,000 voters all year. She's been measuring which voters remain undecided in the presidential election. And this week, Lynn Vavreck got the same email from many, many friends.
So many people send me this clip. You would not believe it.
This election will determine the future of our country. And this election will be determined by the undecided voter.
This is the link that Lynn got. It's a short skit from last week's Saturday Night Live on undecided voters, and, well, it's pretty self-explanatory.
Before you get our vote, you're going to have to answer some questions. Questions like,
when is the election? How soon do we have to decide?
What are the names of the two people running? And be specific.
Who is the president right now? Is he or she running? Because if so, experience is maybe something we should consider.
Now, as we mentioned, Lynn Vavreck says undecided voters are just under 4% of the electorate. I asked her who they are and whether there's any truth in that SNL skit.
This is the problem. The premise is wrong. It isn't that they're looking at Mitt Romney and looking at Barack Obama and weighing them. They're not looking yet. So if we really wanted to write a skit that would stand next to Saturday Night Live, it would be, you know, the single mother who has three kids, who has to get up early to make them breakfast, get them to three different schools because they're in different grades, go to her job, worry about what she's making for dinner. She's like 20 days until the election. That's an eternity for her. So we rush a little bit to judgment when we say, oh, these people are idiots. Well, they're not. They're busy people for whom politics is not the number one concern in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, this idea that they're I think to the contrary, I haven't heard people say that they're idiots. I've just heard people say this is the most desirable, you know, this is the group of voters we are after.
Well, first, I think we should stipulate that the reason they get so much attention from the media is because they are the only thing left that's moving. You know, nothing is more boring to a reporter than the same thing happening today that happened yesterday. I think it's a little unfair to say that the election is turning on their decision. It reminds me a little bit of the student who comes into my class at UCLA and says to me, "Oh, Professor Vavrick, your B is going to keep me out of law school." Well, yeah, my B and all the other Bs that you got before mine. So just because mine comes last doesn't mean that it's pivotal. But if the election were a blowout, their decision wouldn't matter at all.
You actually have been researching a group of self-declared undecided voters since the beginning of this year, since January 1st, and going back once a week to find out, you know, where they stand. How many of them have changed their minds?
So among the set of people who claim they are still undecided, many of them actually call themselves Democrats or Republicans. It's about a third Democrat, a third Republican, a third Independent. The percentage of people who have changed their mind at least once is roughly 7%, moving either from Obama to Romney or Romney to Obama. The undecideds are breaking, and they are breaking in interesting ways.
How are they breaking?
Well, since July, they are, as a whole, breaking for Obama. About 60% of undecided voters are women. And women undecided voters who have made up their minds are breaking heavily for the president. 75% for Obama, 25% for Romney. So women are more of the undecideds, and they're breaking predominantly for Obama.
Lynn Vavrick, she's a political scientist at UCLA. Remember, undecided voters are around 4% of the population in key swing states, Virginia, Florida, Ohio, Iowa, New Hampshire, Colorado. That comes out to about 900,000 people. Or, as former Clinton White House advisor Paul Begala said, the American president will be selected by fewer than half the number of people who paid to get into a Houston Astros home game last year. Speaking of baseball, here's Mark Hochman again, that sports talk show host who said he was undecided but is actually voting for President Obama.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I have a difficult time believing people are really undecided at this point in the election. I think you have to know where you're going at this point.
Mark, can we talk baseball for a sec?
Sure.
Tigers, Cards, or undecided?
Wow. Who am I rooting for, or who do I think?
You sound undecided.
I am undecided on that one.
Stay with us. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Over the past 5 years, almost a dozen Western tourists, all young, mostly women, who've been traveling in Southeast Asia, have died quickly and unexpectedly under mysterious circumstances. All of those cases caught the attention of science writer Deborah Blum, who's written about them for Wired magazine. She was interested in what happened largely because Deborah Blum is one of the foremost experts on poison. She even wrote a book about it. In fact, she knows so much about poison that she could probably kill you and me and anyone else and get away with it.
My husband does not drink coffee with me in the same room. He hasn't for years.
Anyway, back to the story. Deborah Blum first heard about these mysterious deaths this past summer. Two Canadian sisters, Audrey and Nomi Bélanger, set off on a trip to Thailand in June.
They were doing a sister vacation in the beautiful resort islands. I've seen this described as a kind of 20-something rite of passage vacation. You go, you hang out on these beautiful beaches, you drink cocktails.
The islands are famous for their white sand beaches, and at night,
especially after dark, the beaches of these islands become a big cocktail party. And one of the things that a lot of the tourists there drink are called bucket drinks, where people will come to your table or your chair or where you're sitting in the sand, and they'll mix up a drink for you.
And it was at one of these after-dark beach parties where local police say the sisters ingested DEET, which is better known as the chemical used to repel mosquitoes. But why DEET? Well, Thai investigators say it's a common ingredient in those bucket drinks because it creates a high. Now, that theory didn't sit right with Deborah Blum.
So the first thing I thought when I saw DEET was, how much DEET would you have to drink to have that kind of reaction? Because everyone I know in the world has had some DEET exposure. The explanation by the police were so devious and made so little sense. When I did continuing research on the bucket cocktail theory, I don't know where that came from. There's absolutely zero evidence that DEET is used in bucket cocktails.
They went to a party. Mm-hmm. That was where they were last seen. And then the next day they were found dead in their hotel rooms.
That's exactly right. These were very gruesome deaths. I've asked myself this, you know, did no one hear them? Did they not call for help?
About a month later in Vietnam, something similar happened. Two women in their mid-20s, an American from Wisconsin, Carrie Bowerman, and a Canadian named Kathy Nguyen.
And they were taking a vacation and backpacking through Vietnam. And they stopped one night at a touristy beach town. They arrived one day. The next day, they were in the hospital. And they were, both of them, suffering from symptoms of what looked like an acute poisoning, incredible difficulty breathing. They were hypotensive. Their blood pressure was plummeting. They were acutely nauseated. They were slipping in and out of consciousness.
Kathy was eventually discharged from the hospital. When she returned later that night to visit Carrie, she found out her friend was dead. 2 days later, so was she.
My understanding is that the Vietnamese had the Canadian woman cremated. They haven't sent the results. They haven't told what chemicals they tested for. They haven't provided any of the actual details. They've just said, no, it couldn't possibly be poison.
These four deaths are part of a larger pattern. 9 deaths in the last year and a half in Thailand and Vietnam. All Western tourists, mostly young. 7 of them in just one Thai hotel.
The theory there, and this was raised with these two women in Vietnam, was that they were using an organophosphate pesticide. It's called chlorpyrifos, which is actually banned in buildings in the United States. And it's been used heavily and widely in some of these Asian countries to fight bed bugs. The reason, though, chlorpyrifos is banned in residential spaces in the United States is not because it's phenomenally toxic, but because it's linked to developmental problems. In other words, if you had kids in the building.
Why would it kill them and not other people presumably exposed to this in the hotel?
See, that doesn't make any sense, does it? Because if you're doing widespread fumigation for bed bugs, it's not like you're just picking one room.
Do you think insecticides and DEET had anything to do with the deaths of these women?
I find the DEET theory ludicrous. I mean, I can't even figure out where they came up with it. I've heard from scientists who study DEET who say the same thing. So I don't think it's DEET. Do we have any good police work that tells us what that poison was? We don't. Is there a good reason to suspect that some of this might be deliberate? Yeah, I think there. It makes a lot of sense. And if I just go back to these young women on Phi Island, why would two young girls out of the crowds of people on the beach be the only ones who die from a poison cocktail? That doesn't sound to me like, you know, you're randomly drinking the popular beach drink. That sounds to me like someone picked you out.
Deborah Blum is still investigating these cases. In Thailand, police say they concluded theirs this week. The deaths, they say, were caused by DEET. You can find more on the story at Deborah Blum's blog, Elemental, at Wired.com. About a year ago, Jason Sheeler was working on a story for the Dallas Morning News. It was about those iconic silk scarves made by the French design house Hermès. And Jason wanted to know why an Hermès scarf costs $400, because to him and to many people, it's just a small square of silk, and $400 seemed really high. So Jason went to Lyon in southern France, where those scarves are made, and he discovered the reason behind it.
They own the land in Brazil where the silkworms are grown and harvested, right? They own the mulberry, the groves of mulberry trees that the silkworms feed on to make, you know, the most perfect silk thread ever. So they own every bit of the process. And so they make their own weave. They have their own looms. They own their own worms, right? Hermès owns every single part of the process. And so that's how it ends up being $410. And then in addition to that, you know, then the silk is brought back to Lyon and where it's been made.
This is the actual sound of one Hermes scarf, a single one, being hand-cut and hand-sewed around the edges. It takes a few hours just to get this right, and it's perfect. Tight and flawless and classic in every way. It's the scarf that could allow Jackie Kennedy or Grace Kelly to go out and maybe snatch a few extra seconds of anonymity and still look fabulous. Anyway, when Jason Sheeler was at the Hermes factory, he discovered something else unusual about Hermes scarves.
So I got there, and the first day I was in the scarf-making factory, this imperious French woman threw out this really great big scarf with a turkey on it, and it had Texas on it. And she said, "You are from Texas, no?" She said, "Do you know Kermit?" And I was like, "Who or what? What's Kermit?" And she told me that there was a man in Texas who designed scarves for Hermes, and he's the only American ever to do it. So I immediately was fascinated. I was like, of all people, there's a guy in Texas. And then she said, and as a matter of fact, he's a postman.
A postman in Waco, Texas. And his name is Kermit Oliver. Now, that part of the story didn't end up in Jason Sheeler's article, but he couldn't get it out of his head. And so around that time, he called the Texas Monthly, and he said, "There's a postman in Waco who designs scarves for Hermes." And they told him, "Call him up." So Jason Sheeler did.
Just to get him on the phone took about 5 or 6 voicemails, you know, really just saying, "Hi, it's Jason once again from Texas Monthly. You know, please give me a call back."
And after several weeks, Kermit Oliver did. He reluctantly agreed to meet with Jason. He didn't want the attention, but Jason was persistent, and eventually he headed to Waco, to Kermit Oliver's modest home in a rough part of the city.
And every single bit of wall space is covered with his incredibly beautiful, colorful paintings, most involving portraits of his children, of farm animals. There's this great big huge painting. There's a cat sitting on the back of a cow. The cow has a floral necklace around its neck. These beautiful pastorals. A great big portrait of his father sitting astride a horse. And he's sitting there on a chair, on a quilt-covered chair. And he rises to meet me. And I tell him what an honor it is to meet him. I said, "You've just got the most amazing story." And he says, "Well, why don't you tell me what my story is?"
Kermit Oliver is almost 70. He wears his mustache, trim and neat. And the thing you need to know about him is he doesn't understand what the fuss is about, even though he's one of the most important living African-American painters in America and the only American artist ever to design Hermes scarves. He's actually designed 16 of them.
Kermit would tell you he's a Garrett artist. He doesn't believe that he can make a living as a painter. He doesn't even believe he's that good. Those are his words. He just likes to paint. He works overnight in the post office, and he comes home and he paints a little bit, takes a nap, and does it all over again. He survives on 2 or 3 hours of sleep, eats a sandwich on his break at the post office. He gets a 30-minute break, and then he goes back to sorting mail.
We tried to contact Kermit Oliver and his family for this story, but they didn't return our calls. And not because they're rude or he's rude, but rather because Kermit's just a deeply humble person.
I think that's a mystery to everyone. I even sometimes wonder if it's a mystery to Kermit, because I think he enjoys people.
That's Shelby Marcus, and we'll hear more from her in a moment. She's the wife of Lawrence Marcus, as in Neiman Marcus, the legendary Dallas-based department store that was instrumental in bringing Kermit Oliver to the attention of Hermes.
He's private. That's the only thing I can think of. He has a need for privacy.
Kermit Oliver went to art school at Texas Southern University in Houston in the late 1960s, and almost immediately, his work stood out.
His art is colorful. He works with very, very, very rudimentary supplies. He works with acrylic paint that he gets at Michael's. He works on very cheap watercolor paper. He draws, and then he paints.
A gallery in Houston recognized his talent and mounted a one-man show of his work in 1970, and Kermit became the first black artist represented by a major gallery in Houston. And that's how he met Shelby Strope, who worked at another gallery. This was before Shelby met and married Lawrence Marcus, an heir to the Neiman Marcus empire. Now, Neiman Marcus was, and still is, one of the most important retail outlets for Hermes. And in the mid-1980s, Hermes sent one of its top executives to Texas to meet with Lawrence Marcus.
The Hermes company was looking for an artist to do a scarf with a Southwest theme. And Lawrence Marcus said, "You know what? I know the guy. I've got the guy for you."
Lawrence Marcus is now retired. He's in his 90s. And when we reached him at his home in Dallas, he recounted that meeting with Hermes.
The thing that intrigued me and made me think of Hermes for using Kermit's talent was the fact that Kermit tends to design from the outside in. In other words, he designs the frames of the pictures that he's painting, and that's the way Hermes has chosen its path, and it just fit into what Kermit was doing.
Now, by this point, Kermit Oliver's work was going for tens of thousands of dollars. One of his paintings has sold for more than $70,000. And all the while, even to this day, he shows up at the post office in Waco where he sorts mail. Now, the story of Kermit Oliver might have ended there, but his life took a tragic turn in 1998. His youngest son, Christian, got mixed up with a bad crowd of kids in high school, and one night, Christian went out for a joyride with two friends, brothers, and also with Christian's girlfriend, who was in the car. They were drinking, and they were smoking pot, and they decided to rob a house. Now, the owner of the house, Joe Collins, wasn't home, but while the boys were inside, Collins returned, and he discovered Christian and one of the brothers inside his house. And so Joe Collins pulled a gun on them.
He fired at the brother. Christian fired back at Joe Collins. And someone later beat Joe Collins to death. And there was a trial. The two brothers testified for the prosecution. Christian's girlfriend was sent away for life, and Christian got the death penalty.
Kermit Oliver tried to have his son's sentence commuted. Hermes and the Marcus family helped Kermit set up a legal fund. He spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on lawyers, but the sentence stood. And in November 2009, Kermit and his family watched as Christian Oliver was put to death by lethal injection. And according to people who know Kermit, he was never the same after. Here's Shelby Marcus again.
He became even more reclusive, and I believe that he had some searching to do with himself about his religion, because he was so crushed that his son had taken the path that was just not, there was no common thread within his family that would lead one to believe that Christian wouldn't have taken the same path as the other children, but he did not.
To talk about how his faith had shifted, definitely lost his faith, lost his way in the world. And at the same time, having to go to the post office every day, and at the same time, having to create these incredibly luxurious 410 squares of silk that are sold in exclusive boutiques worldwide.
Jason Sheeler's story on Kermit Oliver appeared in the October issue of the Texas Monthly. You can see photos of his work at our website, npr.org. Some of his paintings are also on permanent display at the Museum of Fine Arts in Dallas and in Houston. And in early December, the Hooks Epstein Gallery in Houston will mount a new show of Kermit Oliver's work. Twenty-five years ago, J.R.R. Tolkien released a book he originally wrote for his kids, The Hobbit.
In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. Not a nasty, dirty, wet hole, filled with the ends of worms and an oozy smell, nor yet a dry, bare, sandy hole, with nothing in it to sit down on or to eat. It was a hobbit hole, and that means comfort.
That's Corey Olson reading, of course, the opening lines to The Hobbit. Olson is known as the Tolkien Professor, and his new book is called Exploring J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. Now, The Hobbit isn't just a landmark piece of fantasy literature. It's a movement, a cultural movement, a work that's inspired everyone from director Peter Jackson to the band Led Zeppelin to Leonard Nimoy, who even recorded his own homage to the book in the late 1960s, The Ballad of Bilbo Baggins.
In the middle of the earth, in the land of the Shire, lives a brave little hobbit whom we all admire. With his long wooden pipe, fuzzy woolly toes, he lives in a hobbit hole and everybody knows him, Bilbo.
And if you want to see the video, that go to YouTube. Now, even though it's widely celebrated, The Hobbit's always kind of existed in the shadow of Tolkien's other great work, The Lord of the Rings. And Corey Olson, the self-described Tolkien professor, thinks that's a great shame.
Even people who are Tolkien fans and who really love The Lord of the Rings tend to fall in love with The Hobbit when there are children and then move on to The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion and really not go back very much, and certainly not read The Hobbit with the same kind of attention and respect that they tend to read Tolkien's other work.
Why do you think that happened with The Hobbit?
Well, I think it's several things. The biggest difference, I would say, between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings is the tone and the style. The Hobbit has a narrator character who is very much more intrusive than the narrator character in The Lord of the Rings, and tends to speak more consciously addressing children. And you can see, actually, if you go back and you look at the great popular children's books of the time, you know, of the 1930s and the several decades before that, you can hear the similarity and the tone that Tolkien's going for there with his narrator in The Hobbit, similar to books like Winnie the Pooh and Alice in Wonderland and Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. And you can see some very similar approaches that he's taking there, but it's very different from what he does in The Lord of the Rings.
One of the most memorable scenes in The Hobbit is the so-called riddle scene. And we actually found a clip of Tolkien reading part of that scene. Let's take a listen to it.
All right, said Uther, not daring to disagree and nearly bursting his brain to think of riddles that could save him from being eaten. There are 30 white horses on a red hill. First they champ, then they stamp, then they stand still. That was all he could think of to ask. The idea of eating was rather on his mind. It was rather an old one, too. Gollum knew the answer as well as you do. Chestnuts, chestnuts, he hissed. Teeth, teeth, my precious.
God, the Gollum is just so weird every time I hear his voice.
Yeah.
Corey, but in your book, you actually point to the scene. This is a scene that you think represents a wider story of The Hobbit and what it was meant to be.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I tend to point to this as one of the scenes which not only I think is of really central importance to this book as a whole, but is really for me one of the clearest examples of the kind of thing that I'm talking about. That is, this is on the one hand a really good story. You can hear how interactive, how dynamic Tolkien was making it. You can tell from his reading that this is something that he conceived of as an oral performance. You know, this is something that he used to read to his kids, and The Hobbit still to this day works so well aloud. I've already read it aloud to my sons, and it's fantastic. But while this is, you know, has all of the kind of performative appeal and is really, you know, Gollum is not too scary but quite creepy, and you've got the fun of the riddle game and the kids get to try to guess the riddles and everything, at the same time, there is a lot of sort of complexity here when you look at it carefully. The riddles that each one of them choose to tell and how they express it really, when we pay attention, shows us a very clear picture of Bilbo's bright cheerfulness and Gollum's despair. It's really quite sad. But again, it's not obtrusive. It doesn't force itself upon you. You can just, you know, read it and have fun. And that's what most people do with The Hobbit.
I'm speaking with Corey Olson. He's an assistant professor at Washington College in Maryland. And he's the author of the new book. It's called Exploring J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. Corey, one of the things that I loved about this book, well, looking back on it now, is that Tolkien wrote this for kids, right? I mean, this was written,
yes.
And he didn't sort of whitewash. I mean, there were really dark themes. There are dark
yes.
themes in this book.
He did, as you say, very strongly believe in that. He was born in 1892, so he grew up with a steady diet of Victorian fairy tales and stuff. And there was a trend, of course, in the 19th century to kind of gloss over that stuff. You know, Andrew Lang's collection of fairy tales takes out the more gruesome elements from the Brothers Grimm, for instance. And Tolkien was strongly opposed to this. You know, he said children aren't meant to be Peter Pans. You know, they're not meant to be just sheltered and protected from anything gruesome. They're meant to grow up. And that happens. You know, they can gain wisdom and strength from being exposed to these things and knowing that these things are out there.
This book has incredible staying power. And, of course, everyone's sort of waiting for this film by Peter Jackson, which will come out at the end of this year. But, you know, you think about, like, Harry Potter, which is an incredible series of books. And you, I sometimes wonder if we'll be talking about it in quite the same way we do now in 75 years. But it's 75 years since The Hobbit, and it's still a huge phenomenon. I mean, kids still read it, and adults read it, and there are movies made, and it's incredibly successful.
Yes. You know, he talked a lot about myth and the power of mythic stories, how myths, great myths, really sort of tap into things, images and imaginations and desires and people. And I, you know, I think that was one of the things that he sort of one of his highest aspirations for his own stories is that there might be bits of it, that there might be elements of that kind of mythic appeal in his story. And I think that he succeeded quite remarkably in that, and that that's what I would personally attribute that staying power to.
That's Corey Olson. His new book is called Exploring J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. Corey Olson also teaches at Washington College in Maryland. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Just 2 weeks until we announce the winner of round 9 of our 3-minute fiction contest here on Weekends and All Things Considered. That's where we ask you to come up with an original piece of fiction that can be read in about 3 minutes. In this round, we received nearly 4,000 stories. Now, graduate students from a dozen schools, including from the University of Houston and Indiana University, have read through all of them. And now, our judge this round, Brad Meltzer, is making his decision. Now, he's going to be with us in 2 weeks from today to announce the winner, and that story will be published in the December issue of the Paris Review. Until then, here's an excerpt from one of our favorites. It's called Executive Copy.
Gentlemen, I don't mean to be impatient, especially as I'm eager for your vote. My attempt at a joke barely gets a smile. I was wondering if we can postpone this until the afternoon. I understand there are a few urgent matters which require my attention, particularly as I have just died. Sir, as you say, you have been shot. We cannot simply put you back into the presidency until we have confirmed that you are in fact fully who you were. Glitches have been known to occur. Remember President Morgan? That was awkward. It was. A full policy change following his would-be assassination. Of course, everyone credited what they thought was his brush with death to a change of outlook, but myself and the guys in this room know it was a programming error, one that turned out to be beneficial in the end, but an error all the same. Someone put a 1 where they meant to put a 0, and he was a different person, and the world changed as a result. It's at this point that I start to wonder if it was accidental. Sure, the presidential cloning practice sees its fair share of conspiracy theories around the Oval Office water cooler, but now that I'm subject to it, I really begin to wonder, am I who I was, and does it matter?
That's our Susan Stamberg reading an excerpt from the story Executive Copy, written by Corey Shatner of New York City. You can read more of Executive Copy and other favorites at our website, npr.org/3-minute-fiction. And that's 3-minute fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. And it's time now for music.
I can't believe Seth is missing his favorite band. No, it's one thing blowing me off. Blowing off Death Cab?
Blowing off Death Cab? That's a scene from the TV show The OC. It went off the air a few years ago, and the Death Cab reference? That would be Death Cab for Cutie, the Seattle area band that became huge after appearing on The OC. Death Cab for Cutie became one of the biggest acts in indie rock, all behind the voice of its frontman, Ben Gibbard, who is one of the most influential figures in indie music. He's just released a solo album of songs that he says aren't quite the right fit for Death Cab. It's called Former Lives. He's been waking all through the night and pacing around in the moonlight, 'cause these same dreams won't let them be. Ben Gibbard wrote some of the material while going through a very public breakup, his divorce from actress Zooey Deschanel. He describes the record this way. He says, songs that span 8 years, 3 relationships, living in 2 different places, drinking and then not drinking.
You know, I think it was Hemingway that said that we are strongest in our broken places. And I'm paraphrasing that. But, you know, and I'd like to think that as I move through my life as a songwriter, you know, part of my impetus for writing songs is to gain strength in those places that either are or once were. I just can't get to sleep. Thinking about what you do to me. You're like a flower garden buried in snow. You're a hard one to know.
And just to clarify, Ben, Death Cab for Cutie is not over. You are still making music together.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I think that there's no doubt in any of our minds that we have a lot of things to say and a lot more music to create.
You were born and raised in Washington State. Your fans most sort of associate with Seattle. You are sort of around the age where you were just sort of coming of age at the end of that kind of like grunge explosion, the sort of Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden era in Seattle. And then you guys formed a band several years after that was over. Was there a feeling in Seattle at that time that, you know, if you were a band, you kind of missed the boat?
It was an interesting time to come of age because I think that everybody that I knew had a sense of pride in the fact that the music that was being made in the Northwest was getting some national recognition, but also a very high level of trepidation that these outside influences were not necessarily good for the music. You know, it struck me as a kid who grew up watching MTV and seeing, you know, big hair, you know, metal bands kind of all over the place. And, you know, there was a moment when I was 12, 13 years old that I really believed that you couldn't be in a band unless you could grow your hair like that and you could play guitar like that. I mean, I really believed that because that's all I saw on TV.
And yet you were the complete opposite of that. I mean,
well, yeah, exactly.
You were probably a little bit of a nerd.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, as I kind of became aware of college radio, became aware of underground music, it made a real impression on me to see these bands loading their own gear up onto the stage, you know, and setting everything up and then playing for 45 minutes and then tearing everything down and then selling T-shirts and CDs and 7-inches at the merch table. I mean, this was like, these were our heroes. So, you know, I think that when we started this band, our heroes sold 10,000 records, you know. Our bar was fairly low. And as our band has kind of reached the heights that we have kind of gotten to, you know, commercially and otherwise, it's all been gravy, you know, because none of us ever really expected it.
I'm speaking with Death Cab for Cutie's frontman, Ben Gibbard, about his new solo record. It's called Former Lives. Probably, I think, one of the most memorable songs on this record is one that you did with Amy Mann. The song's called Bigger Than Love.
It's bigger than love, brighter than all the stars combined.
I was reading about how you based this on real quotes, love letters, between F. Scott Fitzgerald and his wife, Zelda.
I really fell in love with a book of letters called Dearest Scott, Dearest Zelda that is correspondences between the two of them beginning in their courtship and ending at the end of their lives. You know, when he was out in Los Angeles working as a screenwriter and she was in Asheville in a mental facility. And it's a really wonderful, really touching book because no matter what stage of a relationship one might be in, it is inspiring to kind of read the correspondence between two people throughout their entire relationship, and starting with the moments when they are completely enamored with each other and they can't bear to spend an hour apart, all the way through, you know, there's a letter that's incredibly devastating that Zelda writes.
I live with my memories, the bustling fervor of New York.
Talking about being in New York, and they had fought and broke the bathroom door. These very kind of jarring images that, you know, even if you don't have any other context for why they were fighting, why the bathroom door was broken, you can still see the two of them and you can see this event happening. And it was, found it really, really moving.
Oh, what of our daughter? Oh, what of the love that we once shared? This living in silence, battered but not beyond repair.
His relationship, F. Scott Fitzgerald's relationship with his wife, was sort of endured a great deal of public scrutiny. And, of course, you were in a relationship that was under a great deal of public scrutiny with the actress Zoe Deschanel. You were married. You call this record Former Lives. How would you describe the life you're living now?
Well, you know, I'm living somewhat nomadically now. You know, I've gone going through, you know, a divorce is not fun, and as anybody who's gone through it knows. And I've been doing so much traveling for work. I feel like, you know, I'm enjoying this period of kind of rediscovery of who I am as a person. You know, I think before I can move forward in my life in any kind of meaningful way, I think it's something I need to kind of finally address.
How are you holding up?
I'm doing good. I realize that answer sounded incredibly dire, maybe kind of very serious, but, you know, I'm you know, life is wonderful, and it's been really rewarding.
That's Ben Gibbard, frontman for Death Cab for Cutie. His first solo album is called Former Lives. Ben, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
And you can hear a few tracks from that record by visiting our website, nprmusic.org. It's been in a basement of a ending October 21st, 2012. That's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our program was directed by Lauren Silverman. The production staff includes Becky Hersher, Phil Harrell, Brent Bachman, Amy Held, Kenya Young, and Brenda Salinas. Our interns are Acacia Squires and Barbara Sprunt. Our weekend web producers are Melissa Goh, Stephanie Federico, Krishna Dev Cullimore, Dana Farrington, and Steve Mullis. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Tony Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend.